Hello everyone, Brendan here. I just wanted to give you all a quick update on Flight Through Entirety before we start the episode proper. We've got a situation in the next couple of months where it's going to be difficult for us all to get together to record. So we've taken the decision that after this week, our Snake Dance episode, we're going to be going fortnightly until the beginning of Season 21, possibly a few episodes in there, but during Season 21 we will go back to weekly. At this stage we're hoping to keep Bondfinger on monthly, and yeah, just a fortnightly release schedule for Flight Through Entirety. It was either that or put all of Season 20 out weekly and then have a long break, and while we have done that before, this time we decided we wanted to keep our releases up as long as possible. There may be a little bit of a gap in November, depending on what we can get recorded in the next month. But thank you very much for understanding. There will still be regular episodes of Flight Through Entirety. Sorry this one's a bit late, but I do hope you enjoy it. Thank you. Listener, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast hosted by the five faces of delusion. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
And I'm Todd. I'm not deluded. The others will disagree with me after this particular recording, but I swear to God, I'm not.
But the listener may find themselves deluded by the time we get to the end of the sequel to Kinder, Snake Dance.
Well, this is mine, and I've really got nothing. I have no opinion on this story at all.
Excellent. So can I talk?
Yes. I'm going to throw it to Todd.
So I wasn't here for the love fest that was Kinder, where I almost wanted to bath in my breakfast. My opinion of Kinder is a bit different to everybody else's, and I quite like it now, especially the Mary Morris stuff, but I don't connect with
Hindle.
That leaves me stone cold dead. I don't like all the stuff in Tegan's mind. And so I know that you guys put some really good point of view across on all of that, and I can understand where you're coming from. But I give it to 6, 6.5. As a child, Kinder was my most hated Doctor Who story of all time. When I watched it, I literally gave it 1 out of 10. So when I came to this story, Snake Dance, you can imagine my overwhelming joy at having the Mara back for this, and I gave this less than what I gave to Kinder.
Really?
So that's where I'm coming from with this entire story and podcast. So if Kinder has gone up, obviously, 6 times over in my opinion, when I came to this, I knew in my heart that, you know, it was something that I hoped that I would discover would be, you know, at least better than what I thought. And I have to say, I think of all the Peter Davisons, this is my biggest surprise of the whole lot. And I really enjoyed watching the majority of this story. It's not without its faults, including virtually all of episode 3, where the Doctor is locked in a cell and I just think is just tedious to the extreme and stops the story dead. But the thing that I found really intriguing with this is that I start off really interested in the three leads, like, so imagine a bar graph where my interest in with them and their characterization. As the story goes on, my interest in them and their characterization gets less and less and less. At the start of this story, I'm confronted with some stupid woman in a marketplace, some over-the-top seller of Hall of Mirrors, this brat, his stuck-up mother, and some other idiot in government. But that's my 10-year-old self thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So I start off with, you know, limited interest. But the absolute joy is, as I was watching this, like within moments, these other characters in the cast, by episode 3 and 4, I just want to know all about them.
Yeah, yeah.
And you guys have had a love fest with Fiona Cumming from the moment she started directing, and I think that she's quite weak when it comes to doing big technical stuff. But this story just opened my eyes. She is fantastic at casting the right people to bring these characters to life, and it is the absolute strength of this story, and I just adored it.
The great thing about this story, the other great thing, is that there's a world. So Manusa, which is Pali for humanity, in fact, humankind, seems like a kind of place that has a history and a backstory and things. And the fun thing about it is a lot of that backstory is revealed to us in conversation with Tanha and Lon, her son. And that backstory could have just been an exposition dump, but the relationship between those two characters is so great. It's so great. So he's bored. She's terrifically, insanely posh. The two of them really kind of like each other. He's naughty and unpleasant. We're going to next story have, you know, a posh person who is obnoxious and sows trouble, you know, and likes to irritate people. But Martin Clunes in this is just terrific as that character. There's a scene, I think, later on where Tanha's not talking to him because he was really rude to Ambril in the caves and he was being naughty and stuff. And then later on she says something to him and he goes, "Am I forgiven, Mother?" And she says, "Oh, aren't you always?" It's just terrific. And we never see the Federator, we never see their father, but he's got a well-defined character and they're really funny.
Exactly. You see his character and he's not even there.
Yeah.
And that is such a strength. Those two work so well together. Mm. And Martin Clunes, the performance is just brilliant. I mean, he's mega fit as well, can I just say.
Yeah, he looks great. And he, again, it's what you were saying about casting. The casting is so good because at this stage in his life, he is very pretty and sort of classically good looking. And when he's, you know, he's very still at times and he's standing like a Grecian statue and he's got the very full features of his face. His lips are enormous. You know, he has that classical look. And you've got John Carson as Ambril, you know, and he is wonderfully pompous. And you've got Jonathan Morris as Chila, and he's lovely. Like you were saying last week, Todd, the chemistry between Damon and Nyssa was great. It's just turned up to 15 with Chila and Nyssa, you know. They are so adorable together.
He's really pretty, and Fiona, of course, wins points again as the director by putting men in dresses, right?
As she always does.
I do think this, however, that, you know, again, when it's him and Nyssa and the Doctor, Nyssa becomes the third wheel. And it's one of the disappointments I find in this story is the fact that the last time out, he didn't even write her into the story. Nobody bothered. Like, the easiest thing was to write her out rather than to write her in.
Yeah.
Here she's here, but she's very perfunctory. Obviously, Tegan takes the most of the limelight because of her mental condition. But what's Nyssa given to do? Nyssa's given to look after Tegan. She fails at that. Then, of course, Tegan comes back to her and then she runs off and then she fails to find her. And then the Doctor gives Nyssa the great thing of trying to get him out of the cell, and lo and behold, what does she get to do? Rough a few pages on a desk, go down a bland corridor, and she fails at that. You know, her three big moments in this story are screaming, fantastic scream at the end of the cliffhanger where they're going to be all killed, being a bitch to the Doctor when he tries to help her down off the rock cliff, and in episode one when she turns up wearing the most hideous, biggest bow thing ever. They're her three moments. And Sarah Sutton does a wonderful job.
Yeah, she's great.
But I just think the character, again, of the three regulars in this, unfortunately, I just think it's pushed very much. For me, anyway, I just don't think... I wanted more after last week. I wanted her to have more. I just wanted more. And in this, I just was disappointed.
See, I think last week was a bit of a tour de force for Nyssa. And so this week becomes a more of a tour de force for Tegan. And Janet, her Mara performance in this, much like her performance as Tegan, it's moved on from last year. And I think that it's a polarizing performance. I've heard people expressing different opinions. Richard and I were actually discussing it earlier this week because he was saying, "Oh, you know, I'm looking forward to hearing you guys talk about Snake Dance. I think it's going to be really fun, but here's what I think." And he and I are of the same mind that Janet is just really electric in this. Richard's also cited John Carson, who I mentioned earlier. I want to come back to something you were saying earlier, Todd, about the Doctor being locked up for all of episode three. It is a common problem in the Davison era.
Yeah.
And it reaches its nadir with Colin, and that is not the fault of Davison or Colin. But I think this is one story where it actually works.
Why disagree?
Why do you think that, though?
Because this is a story in which the Mara can only be defeated at a certain moment. It can't be defeated before that moment comes. It can't be defeated after that moment. It has to be defeated in the moment of its becoming, which the Doctor will retread next week when Tegan asks him about it. So the Doctor has to be locked up. He has to be locked up for episode three, because otherwise he won't be in the right position to do anything in episode four.
So normally when the Doctor's locked up like that, it's just a delaying tactic to spin the story out and prevent him getting to its resolution.
Now, the thing is here, it's still a delaying tactic to prevent the story getting to its resolution, but that prevention is actually built into the plan of the plot. The other reason I really like the Doctor getting locked up, and again, this is something I was discussing with Richard, as Richard puts it, Pete is the anti-Tom. So Tom would walk into a room and say, "You're all in terrible danger. Something terrible and mysterious is about to happen." And people would go, "Oh, right, okay, well, you come over here and you take charge then." Whereas Pete walks in and says that, and everyone goes, "He's a bloody nutter. Chuck him in the cells until the party's over," which is what real people would do.
In fact, that stuff is great. And that's something that Sandifer refers to as well. Pete's actually a little bit more manic in his performance in this story.
Mm.
And so he does look like a madman. He does look like someone who's, you know, and we gather that there's a whole history of people kind of obsessed with the Mara and with sort of crazy theories about the Mara. And Ambrell, who's this academic who's terribly pompous and self-important, is used to just dismissing those people as crackpots. And Pete looks like a bit of a crackpot the way that he sort of runs around. And it, of course, that's why Ambrell gets so incredibly angry when Pete points out about the five faces of delusion.
Oh, that was so brilliant. That whole, like, just the three actors and the way they perform it. Like, Pete is just utterly sincere and, "Oh, I'm teaching you something here." And John Carson as Ambrell is outraged, and Sheila is trying not to wet his pants laughing. It's such a beautiful little scene. You know, it's not like it has any major bearing on the plot later. Like, the helmet doesn't become important or anything. It's not a MacGuffin, but it's thematic. It's the Doctor is the outsider who is able to see the whole pattern of what's going on, whereas these supposed experts can't see the whole pattern because they don't see their place within it.
I think it's a beautiful moment. I think one of the things when I was watching this is that I felt that the Doctor came across as being autistic in many ways. Like, Nyssa walks in this new costume and he doesn't even register that change. When he's talking to Ambrell and trying to get his point across, he's oblivious to any of the cues to say, "You're not getting your point across." I mean, I teach kids with autism who can't see people's emotions and that sort of thing. So that's the way it came across to me. I know it's supposed to be like, it's supposed to be alien and that sort of thing, but, well, for the last bit of run where I felt Peter's just been very nice, you know, and suddenly there's this sort of big contrast in what he's doing. I mean, I actually think it's really good that I can see this sort of frustration in the Doctor. It reminds me of Pertwee in season 7, where he sort of barges in and everybody, you know, and is having a go at people, saying, warning them, and they're not listening. I think that's really good. And it sells it with Ambrell, who I think his performance is actually, I think, one of the best ever in Doctor Who, because that character could be really crap.
Yeah.
But you know, when you meet reasonable people who can argue any point of view based on their interpretation of facts, but, you know, their interpretation is very narrow.
Yes.
You know, but they're perfectly reasonable to themselves and everybody around them, you know, and I think he does just a brilliant job with that. In the second half of the story, I just feel like the Doctor is in that cell. I don't feel like there's any great, maybe, characterization. He gets to go and meet the man with the snakes and then come back and save the day. So I really like the Doctor's characterization in those first two episodes. I want to go back and watch. I actually want to go back and watch the first two episodes because I had that sort of thing in my head is about the Doctor's performance. Having watched now ahead in season 21 and seeing what Peter's doing in season 21, which I think is great, it's like, this is what I want to come back and watch that.
Yeah.
But the second two episodes, I'm less inclined with his character and everything like that. I just think it's a bit.
He does get a bit de-emphasised in favour of sort of Tegan and what's going on with Amberl and Lon.
I know I'm coming across as overly critical of it. I think Peter does a really great job in this story, mm-hmm. don't get me wrong. Mm. Remember, Peter Davison is my least favourite Doctor, and so for me it's always hard to distance myself from that perception. I think he's really doing a great job here and he's given great material. I think it's the best material he actually has all season. Having Janet have such great material as well, you know.
I don't like her in episode one very much. Like, I don't like when she's wandering through the marketplace with the little earpiece in and being led by the hand and stuff, and she's sort of vulnerable and she's a bit pathetic. And we do mark time a bit at the beginning of episode one with those scenes in the TARDIS. Mm. And maybe we need to do that to kind of sell the possession by the Mara.
Yeah, I think it sells a few. It sells, for instance, that Tegan is now back. Because we didn't have the TARDIS prop in Amsterdam, we don't see her getting into the TARDIS. It kind of sells, she's back on the show. I think the other thing it sells is she's not safe anywhere.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the TARDIS is supposed to be this safe environment, which they'd already started to break down that impression with Earthshock, of course. But she's not even safe in the TARDIS. And Christopher Bailey, the writer, when he talks about this story, he talks about what he saw as some of the frustrations with how Kinder had been mounted. So, for instance, he didn't realise in setting it outdoors that he wouldn't be totally happy with the outdoor set. So he sets it in a market and he sets it indoors. And he's like, oh, okay, I didn't really like the 20-foot high snake, so he makes the Mara smaller. A lot of the production elements of this story and the way they're presented is Christopher Bailey's response to the interpretation of his own work. And he doesn't kind of say, oh, they did it wrong, but he kind of goes, you know, I didn't realise what the program could do well, what it couldn't do well. I looked at what it could do well. It can do interior sets really well and it can do marketplaces and what have you.
I actually think the sort of dragon dance snake that is a big plastic pink snake that's going through the marketplace. That's Christopher Bailey making fun of the snake at the end of Kinder.
Yeah. If this story were made now, the cult of the Mara and people treating the Mara like a toy and selling toys of it, that would be a satire of the action figure market. And I suppose at the time you didn't have Doctor Who action figures, but you had Star Wars action figures, which had massively taken off in those previous few years. So that might be a comment on that.
I guess the whole thing is, like, the reason that the Mara appears in sort of hilarious domestic violence-themed Punch and Judy shows and the reason that you can buy, like, toy snakes and there's the dragon dance is that this is a situation where the Mara is a legend, it's not real, and no one believes in it anymore. And so you've got Amberl, who is interested in the legend of the Mara, has a great deal of knowledge about it, and, you know, wants more. It's his greed for that knowledge that actually leads to the Mara's becoming at the end. Mm. So the Mara's not real. We know it's real because we saw Kinder last year, but for these people, it's not real. So it just goes to show how unprepared they are, you know, to face the threat.
Yeah, it's really great.
I like the fact that the snake is in the Punch and Judy show, but I don't like people watching the Punch and Judy. Like, I hate Punch and Judy. Like, I hate
it. It's awful. And inexplicable.
Watching people watch it is boring. And this time, like last week we had little kids watching some show and they had hideous jumpers. This week the kids are just hideous. You know? And I just sit there going, oh, please shoot me now. Like, I mean, talk about some of the production elements here. Is you've got Fiona doing a fairly good job with the marketplace, trying to sell that. I'm not completely convinced all the time. It's like we've got like one big corridor and an offshoot and that's about it. I don't think there's enough people at the end, you know, as the procession goes through. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's in Doctor Who's limited budget. I love the outdoor sets that are set on film. I think they look fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, that is wonderful. You've then got all the interior sets, which I believe were borrowed off the Song for Europe set and it's been redressed. But at the same time, I don't know, I find them quite sterile, like that corridor that they go down, which, like last week, we had some sort of sterile corridors, blocky sort of white corridors in Ark of Infinity. So for those sequences in those episodes, I get a bit sort of like, okay, it's the same thing. And then we have that cliffhanger with Lon threatening to kill the Doctor with the people wearing the stuff out of Fort Doomsday.
Yeah.
And Nyssa gives a blood-curdling scream, but then
It's another one of those cliffhangers we talked about them last season, the cliffhanger which ends on someone saying, kill him, and then the next episode resumes with someone walking in and saying, stop. And that's what Lady Tanha does here.
You know what? I usually hate it, but the fact that it's her and the way she does it, I actually quite like it.
Yeah. And, you know, Sarah Sutton gives a great scream, but she says in the making of, when I look at that, What exactly am I screaming at? The sword's nowhere near me and I'm grabbing onto Pete's arm. Have I realised I'm allergic to his jacket? I don't know.
It's blood-curdling. She gives the same blood-curdling scream in Terminus as well.
And last week in Ark of Infinity. A good Doctor Who scream, if you like, because one of the stereotypes, and not entirely undeserved, of the female stars of Doctor Who is that they just scream at things. And when they're at their worst, when they're written at their worst, yes, they do. But when they're written at their best, the screams are occasional, they're truly terrifying and emotional, and they're effective because of that. So, yeah, Nyssa screams in, what, Fort of Doomsday, and she does scream in these three stories here. But each time it's like, no, that's an understandable reaction. Not so much in Snake Dance, unfortunately. No. A word about the sets, and this came from Richard, and we would be in great trouble if we didn't include it.
Yeah.
The Mara Cave. It's German expressionism.
Of course it is.
Can I talk about the fact that Tegan leads Lon to the Mara Cave and then she gets to disappear for about 15 to 20 minutes of the story. She's just waiting.
Hanging out in the cave.
Yeah. She's just waiting. She just disappears. And that's one of my problems I have with Kinder is the fact that she's just asleep for a whole episode. He just leaves her hanging. She does get that, is it the cliffhanger where they go, look at me? Look at me, that's right, you will look at me. I remember that as a kid because my sister and I used to grab each other's head and go, look at me, that's right, look at me, look at Mandarin. I don't know why we came up with that, but that's the one overriding memory I have of this.
Well, there's very little peril because, of course, the Mara isn't in it until the very end. It's all about the Mara becoming. So there is actually very little threat leading up to that. But those two cliffhangers, cliffhanger to episode one and to episode two, are both about Tegan being really scary. And she really manages that well. And those scenes with the snake skulls, so first in the fortune teller's crystal ball and then replacing her head in the funhouse mirror, I think they're really frightening and really effective.
Yeah, and for once, the CSO in Tegan's dream sequence very early on and her just sort of being, not actually walking, but being moved up the staircase into the mouth of the cave, it's really well done. Mm. You kind of expect Doctor Who to have dodgy CSO, but they start to use it a bit more sparingly in the 1980s and it's kind of like, no, let's actually get the shots right. Let's not have another Underworld or the Mutants or something like that. Let's actually make this look as good as possible. And that dream is terrifying.
Is that the dream where she's lying in bed? She goes, I'm in my garden, silly.
Oh, well, that's later on. But even that's, you know, that's lovely. That's Janet. And it's a little bit silly, but it's a little bit menacing as well.
And she tells lies in her garden or something like it. There's some moral failing that's causing the Mara to have some kind of toehold.
Or you know, is the Mara now seeping back into her childhood? And it's open to interpretation. I'm not going to try and make an answer here.
I agree with you in that I like Janet's performance in this immensely. Like, I think she is really great. The Kinder performance, I think, is much broader, and I still think she's in her Playhouse acting stage. I know you guys disagree with me possibly with that, but I prefer this performance, and that's probably why I don't like – it's another thing about Kinder I don't like – as much in retrospect. Last week we had one monster which was called the Urgon and it killed no one. This week we have the Mara and it kills no one.
Actually, no one dies in this story.
That's right. Yep. And that's not a bad thing.
No, that's good.
But I just begin to get a bit sick that, you know, next week actually nobody dies except the people who want to die. And the week after that, the big, huge creature that's in there kills no one. Like, it just becomes this pattern of the creature or whatever kills no one. And it's something that possibly thematically I have a problem with. Watching things in order, it really began to do my head in.
You're not having actual proper monsters that are a little bit more conceptual or something.
For me, I need to feel a threat, a real threat that people have died. For me, that's my interpretation of Doctor Who, whereas this is obviously on a different level and I don't connect with it as much.
Right.
I will say this season runs into a bit of a problem, and it's a bit of a problem of overpromise and underdeliver, because the first few scripts were sort of conceptualized, and it was like, oh, you know, we'll bring back Omega for a story, and we should do another Mara story that was quite popular last season. Oh, and we're bringing back the Black Guardian. And someone went, oh, hold on. So far, we've got an element from the past in every story. Let's advertise the season as that. And of course, they were going to end on a Dalek story, which doesn't end up happening. But the problem is, you know, it's kind of like, we've got elements from the past. We've got Omega, and we've got the Mara from 6 months ago, and we've got the Black Guardian.
Three times over.
Oh, and the White Guardian, you know, and the Master from 3 months ago, and Daleks. It's like, and it led to that fan rumor that Terminus was going to have the Ice Warriors in it, which apparently was never even considered, but people were clutching at bringing this old stuff back. But it doesn't look like they've actually considered what do people want to come back. When you look at the 50th anniversary seasons, Series 7, you've got a Dalek story, you've got a Weeping Angel story, you've got an Ice Warrior story, and you've got a Cyberman story.
I have no memory of Series 7.
Series 7's greatest crime is that it's a bit forgettable.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Oh, and of course it has
Unit.
Solarian and Unit, you know. So that had sort of organic stories grown around these returning elements. Whereas I think the returning elements this season, and Snake Dance is probably the exception in that Snake Dance is a bloody good story in its own right with a returning monster.
Yeah, you could have done Snake Dance, and in fact it kind of wants there to be a sequel in a way,
yeah,
just given
yeah.
the way that Tegan is left at the end of Kindar. So it kind of happens naturally, and if it hadn't been the 20th anniversary, we probably would still have seen a sequel to Kindar.
Yeah, whereas I think some other stories in the season, not all of them, but some other stories in the season, once they've decided on that a monster from the past in every story hook, they just kind of go, we've got Omega in a story. Okay, what's the story? We've got Omega in a story. You know, it's like there's, I would say, at least three stories this season. Snake Dance is not one of them, but Arc of Infinity is, where they've gone, oh, we've got this returning monster, and we've got this returning monster, you know, and they think that's going to be enough.
And it's just not enough.
Yeah.
And in fact, what they do with the Mara in this is, I think, really incredibly clever, because when we first meet the Mara, they're some strange force from the dark places of the inside. They're kind of supernatural or demons or something like that. They come into our reality through the, you know, dreaming of an unshared mind. And they're completely spoken of in sort of magical or mythological terms. And in this story, we actually get the origin of the Mara. We actually find out how they were created. And it is like a science fiction-y thing. There's a lost technology that created these crystals that reified people's thoughts, turned thoughts into reality. But the people were evil. Or there was evil inside those people, the same way that there's evil inside little baby Tegan in her garden telling lies, and that evil creates the Mara. And so the Mara is the result of human evil. It's something that people have created. And so it is science fiction-y, and there's talk of sort of zero gravity and all of that sort of stuff and flawless crystals and things, but it doesn't rob it of its mythology. You know, like it's not a big Ophidian monster that evolved on the planet Maros, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
something stupid. It's still sort of symbolic of what it had been symbolic of in Kindar. I think it's really good.
The best science fiction is not the science fiction that's based around the fact that we're on rocket ships and flying around suns and what have you. The best science fiction could still be told in any setting because it's about the species you're looking at. So, you know, usually in our case, it's humanity. Now, obviously, you've got writers like Larry Niven who will write stories where there are no human characters, but we can still recognize humanity, if you like, in the characters, or the whole story becomes about the fact that these characters are totally alien and we cannot recognize anything within them. Yeah, when you get science fiction that is just about the zero gravity welding, mega flimflamity converters.
Like Arc of Infinity, for instance.
Yeah, you know, it's a pulse loop. It's an impulse laser. We've got a molecular zero-G bonding field
Yes, whatever. I think something's happening with the transduction barrier.
Yeah, you know, that probably appeals to a certain audience in the same way that Michael Bay and Roland Emmerich films appeal to certain audiences. And yeah, if you enjoy those, I'm not saying you're wrong. You know,
no, but you are a bad person.
Well, look, I can enjoy a Roland Emmerich film at times, but the point is, if you want sort of meatiness and depth to a story, it has to be a story where if you rip out the decoration, if you like, if you set it in a different place, it still works.
Yeah.
And that is why, and we criticized it at the time, and I still kind of roll my eyes at the fact they did it, so many Hinchcliffe stories were ripped off from classic literature, because remove the context of those stories and the basic idea of Frankenstein and the basic idea of the Thing from Another World and the Loch Ness Monster and that sort of thing, those ideas work in any setting.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Frankenstein's about the humanity of the monster. Forbidden Planet, much like Snake Dance, is about monsters from the id, that yeah. kind of thing. But yet you need to have that humanity in the story, really.
This is a story that has no villain as well, isn't it? But the Mara gets brought about, or nearly gets brought about, because each person there has a flaw.
Yes.
So you have Tegan's flaw. Ambril is greedy for knowledge and greedy for, you know, those artifacts. Lon is arrogant and doesn't really care about anyone.
Yeah.
You know, like all of those things, those are all sort of minor faults. I think Lady Tanha's name means thirst, yes. actually.
Yes.
All of those are just tiny little petty flaws in people's character. And just like the way the Mara was originally created, it's going to be recreated just because the surrounding people all have these sort of moral flaws.
That's very true, and I can see why that's appealing now as an adult. I struggle with the fact that there isn't really, for me, a central sort of villain. And if it is Tegan possessed by the Mara, she was never going to kill anyone, because how could the character live with herself if she did?
Mm.
I mean, that I can see that as being that's obvious.
Yeah.
But it's also a weakness, is the fact that nobody dies, in my opinion.
So there is this sort of strange thing, isn't it? And I feel the same way in some sense, that what I kind of want Doctor Who to be about is, you know, like monsters invading the Earth, or you know, people getting murdered in a confined space or something like that. Like all of that stuff, I think, is really central to what Doctor Who is. And so perhaps we have a run of stories a little bit too long that doesn't have any of that sort of stuff. I guess the last thing that we had was what, The Visitation, where it was just sort of straightforward evil aliens posing a threat.
Oh, Earthshock.
Maybe that was awful.
I kind of forgotten that.
I might feel differently if I watched this in isolation. Someone said to me recently, it might have been a friend of the podcast, Brian Lindsay, said that if you watch all these early Davisons in order, what we're talking about becomes quite obvious and, well, for me, it's a problem. But if you just come in and watch the one story and you haven't watched the other ones around it, you might think more of the story and not – it might not be that much of a problem.
See, I find the opposite thing, in that I enjoy the Davison era much more if I watch it all in context. I see the variations in Peter's performance, because much like you, Todd, he's probably my least favourite. And I know I mentioned last season that I find new things in his performance each time I watch it, and watching the era through once with Rod and then watching it through again for the podcast, I really started to see, actually, there's a lot of subtlety in his performance. And that thing you were talking about earlier, where he's so focused on the problem he has set for himself that he doesn't notice details around him, which, in a way, those details aren't important. That element of the character is usually there to a greater or lesser degree. But I think that element of the character is very greatly dependent on whether Peter likes the script.
I don't necessarily think it's the making of for this one, but in one of the makings of this season, Peter reckons that he plays the Doctor too nicely during this season in particular. You know, at times I think he is too nice over this period of time, but that's not necessarily always the case. I think he's a bit harsh on himself, and it's the script, and it's what characterization they actually give to his Doctor. I think when you get to the moment you get to Warriors of Deep onwards, he is so much better.
I'm really looking forward to that. I'm already finding a lot to enjoy in what he's doing. You know, I've been critical of the whole conception of Pete's Doctor. He's not my least favourite Doctor at all. That one's still to come. But the breathless thing that he does, the running, I really like him panicky. I really like when he's exasperated. I think his relationship with Tegan is terrifically fun. Sometimes he can be really charming. He's not scene-stealing, do you know what I mean? He's not as compelling as his predecessor or even kind of his successor.
Yeah.
But I think it's an acting performance that I really like, and I think it's kind of underappreciated just given the context of the other two Doctors, the two Doctors on either side, and also just given the general low quality of what he's given to do as a script, I think.
Yeah. I agree with you on the low quality with the scripts and what he is elevating that.
Yeah.
I don't think he's underappreciated. My opinion of him is very different to yours.
Yeah.
I think I'm getting more out of his performance,
yeah.
But I still think that it takes up to the five Doctors before he really right. works it out.
I'm not quite up to that yet, and I am looking forward to it. I have a vague memory that you're right, that he really sort of kicks into gear in season 21, and I'm just looking forward to seeing that happen.
There's an energy with somebody leaving. There's an energy. There's this frenetic energy that he has. Mm-hmm. And all those little traits that you've talked about are suddenly not under the surface or downplayed. They're over the surface.
Yeah.
He's using his acting performance to work out what the character's going to be, because essentially he's come into it and no one has any idea of what he's going to be like. And you can see things that he tries in Fort of Doomsday that he never tries again. And then I guess all of that sort of running about being exasperated and stuff is what he ends up adopting, and then he goes in and sort of properly plays that in season 21, do you think? It's like a clear idea of what the character is.
And I also think the writing is there for him as well.
Yes, yeah, the writing definitely improves next year.
See, I think this is still broad strokes, except for Christopher Bailey, who's got it.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't it funny? Sort of, actually, I won't say this is the best story of the season, but it's not far off in this story we're talking about, the quality of the writing, because we know what's coming. thing is, I just want to clarify, when I say he's my least favourite Doctor, that's a bit like me saying my least favourite Avengers sidekick. They're brilliant.
Yeah.
And, yeah, incidentally, I'm sorry, it's Mike Gambit. But
yeah, he's shockingly bad. Whoever let him off Metabolus 3, for God's sake.
But that's the thing. He's still great. But, you know, I'm one of these mad people who probably prefers Tara King and Kathy Gale to Emma Peel. So I can hear Steve over in Western Australia disowning me. At
That is crazy talk.
My big thing, Brendan, is that I just wish the stories that he was given in the first two series were consistently better. Like, I have episodes that I really like, and then there's episodes that I don't like.
Yeah.
Or there's a through line through a story that I really like, and there's other things that I really dislike. And there's nothing thus far I can give more than 8 out of 10 to. That's just me.
Yeah.
And this gets an 8. And it's sort of like I want to be able to say in these two series, any of these stories could be in my top 20 Doctor Who's. And quite honestly, as I sit here now, I can't say that.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's probably one in these two seasons that I could put inside my top 20. And I think part of the problem is...
Are you're not going to tell us what it is?
Not yet. A lot of the creative decisions, there seems to be an air of it'll be all right on the night. And you know what? You might be able to manage that with one story per season, but when you've got that attitude for 6 or 7 stories... I think the successes become more a matter of luck than a matter of skill. And the only time I can really think of, oh, it'll be all right on the night, has actually worked out in Doctor Who is City of Death.
Mm.
And that everyone on that just kind of goes, yeah, lightning just struck. You know, we got the perfect cast and the perfect script and the perfect location. You know, I think Snake Dance kind of exemplifies that in the same way. You do have a great cast and you've got a cracking script, which probably, as much as I love it, could do with a bit of tightening.
Well, going back to what you're saying about episode 3, where we disagree, I think if they'd said you've got 3 episodes, the Doctor wouldn't have been in that cell for 3 episodes, and everything would have been fast forwarded, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's where I come from with that bit of perspective. So, and I think, you know, having the director they had, the writer they had, and the director, she just casts it and it just sells it, and that's why I generally like this.
Yeah. I think there is a sort of strange problem, as I hinted before, at the structure, which is no monster actually really appears until the last 5 minutes of the story.
Yeah.
There's a lot of waiting. But the waiting is, I think, really entertaining and for the reasons you identified. Can we talk about the snake?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I don't care that the snake at the end of Kinder is terrible, and it is terrible. It's a big plastic snake. It can see over the mirrors, so I don't know why it's affected by being trapped in a circle of mirrors. It can't even see them. It's huge and kind of silly and unconvincing, but it doesn't matter, just generally because that story is quite good. Here, the snake, I think, is really, really surprisingly effective. So it doesn't for a second not look like a puppet. You know, it's obviously a puppet, but this time it's glistening.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there's an organic quality to it.
So it feels like it's got a mouth full of venom. It's got an articulated tongue. It just looks eviler and more frightening than the other one. And so I think it's really good. It's yet another monster that pours snot out of its head when it's killed. We didn't talk about Omega last week and Snotty McSnot face.
Yeah, that's three stories running.
Yeah,
where snots come out of the alien. It's the BBC snot machine.
And the fact that the dispatch the Mara and genuinely kill it and then they're out of there too. There's no stupid goodbyes or anything like that. It's just Pete says the Mara has been destroyed. We come full circle from the beginning of the story where we had thought it destroyed, but it wasn't. Yep, it's still alive. Yep. And Pete just very definitely says the Mara's been destroyed and then we're out. I think that's really good.
The sound design of that scene with Pete facing down the Mara with Tegan's face in the middle of it, that is terrifying. I was terrified by that when I was 11 years old.
And the silence, there's a really eerie silence once the Mara's been defeated as well.
Yeah, like, you know, Peter Howell doesn't go ding, 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 ding. There was a scene recorded of them leaving,
right,
which Fiona Cumming dropped mainly for timing reasons. Episode 4 runs to 24 and a half minutes.
Right.
But in that scene, yeah, it would have been a far worse ending. It's in the deleted scenes and pretty much it's a few hours later, the whole market gathers to see the Doctor, Nyssa and Tegan off and thank them for dealing with the Mara. And kind of Lon and Amber go, oh, we were so stupid. Yes, you were. It's well performed.
They've learned a valuable lesson.
Yeah, exactly. It's the cousin of the scene with Hindle and Sanders saying, thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
I love
at
that
the
scene.
End. But it's not as good.
Yeah.
There is one rather lovely bit at the end where they talk about could the Mara come back? And the Doctor says, well, you know, it comes from your negative impulses and the fact that you don't deal with them and you don't talk about them. So the choice is up to you. And that's the last line. And that is a lovely last line. But the rest of the scene building up to it is just kind of Scooby-Doo. So kudos to Fiona Cumming for dropping that scene and just ending us on. It's weird. It's a triumphant, it's a downbeat triumphant ending.
It's really raw and emotional, and Janet does a great job.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
She's such a long way away from the person who came into the TARDIS and told us her name was Tegan all those years ago.
It really is a joy to see her. I'm really surprised and delighted by this story.
And you know what? You know how I said I don't think this is the best story of the season? I still think it's probably the best story so far. For Davison, for the Davison era.
I'm expecting it to be the best story of the season, but I haven't watched Enlightenment yet on the way through for the podcast, so we'll see.
Interesting. I really liked The Visitation. After listening to your podcast, you did a number on the gentleman. But I went into The Visitation with low expectations, like from the previous time I watched it, so I think it sort of went a bit too high. Like I gave it 8.5, but I've now pegged it back to 8. And as Nathan said, it's just humorless. So so I actually think I prefer to watch this than that. So this is my favourite Davison thus far.
Mm.
Hooray.
Thank you.
well as we take off from the Noosa. We'll be back with our podcast on Mordrin Undead. Until then, you can find us on flightthroughentirety.sexy, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. Over on Bonfinger, we have various Roger Moore commentaries up to and including Moonraker. That's on bonfinger.com, Bonfinger on Facebook and iTunes, and Bondfingercast on Twitter. And over on YouTube, Doctor Who in 10 Seconds is still up to Season 6, but Season 7 is coming out next week. So until next time, may none of your snakes die dribbling snot out of their eyeballs. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
See you later, Mara.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley and Brendan Jones.
Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb.
This episode, Tiny Little Petty Flaws, was recorded on July 24th, 2016. The next episode will be released on August 21st. Offering temptation in fear, despair and greed, is this Doctor Who or Big Brother?
I'm going to burp.
Oh dear.
Sorry, I've been drinking soda water.
I wasn't expecting that.
That's the Mara. Assuming people.